Welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, the place where you're in the know. You can find us online at commonwealthclub.org, on Facebook and Twitter, and on our YouTube channel. I'm Josh Richmond, political reporter for the Bay Area News Group and your moderator for today's program. And I'm very pleased to welcome today's guest, Dr. Ron Paul. Ronald Ernest Ron Paul is an American physician, author, and former politician who served 12 terms in Congress and ran for president in 1988 as a Libertarian and in 2008 and 2012 as a Republican. Throughout his career, Dr. Paul has earned a reputation as one of the world's foremost and most outspoken advocates of individual liberty, privacy, limited government, sound monetary policy, and non-interventionist foreign policy. Dr. Paul is a critic of the federal government's fiscal policies, especially the existence of the Federal Reserve, the tax policy, the military-industrial complex, and the war on drugs. He was the first chairman of the conservative PAC Citizens for a Sound Economy and has been characterized as the intellectual godfather of the Tea Party movement. He is the author of 10 books, including 2013's The School Revolution, A New Answer for Our Broken Education System, 2011's Liberty Defined, The 50 Urgent Issues That Affect Our Freedom, and 2009's End the Fed. Dr. Paul and his high school love and wife of more than 55 years, Carol, have five children, including Rand Paul, the junior U.S. Senator for Kentucky, who is now mulling whether to follow his father's footsteps, not only to Congress, but onto the presidential campaign trail in 2016. Now 79, Dr. Paul is the president of the Free Foundation, president of the Ron Paul Institute for Peace and Prosperity, chairman of the Campaign for Liberty, and has almost 1.4 million followers on Facebook and almost 500,000 on Twitter. Please welcome Dr. Ron Paul. So let's start with a few questions from your book, from Liberty Defined. I was particularly interested in an area. You wrote a chapter on envy. To hate is always injurious to the soul. To hate because another person or class of people has done well for itself compounds the injury, but that is precisely what policies that survive solely to punish people for making money or for living well are really all about. You also wrote that we should learn the virtue of celebrating success, or as the ancient philosophers said, learn to be inspired by the success of others. We should try to emulate success, not punish it. I noticed you had a chapter on envy, but not one on greed. Doesn't this chapter sort of presuppose a level playing field in which anyone inspired by success has at their disposal the same resources, whether it's education or access to capital or what have you, with which to achieve it? And hasn't the deck somewhat been stacked in this country for the past 30, 35 years?
I look at envy as being an excess of greed. And these are tricky terms because there's some subjective interpretation of what it is. If you see somebody else with something, it's almost very natural for us to say, I sort of wished I had that too, because I've experienced that myself, you know. But the big question is, what do you do with it? Does that mean you work harder? So some people casually say greed is just looking at somebody and looking at this is wonderful stuff, and he goes and works harder. But if you're envious, you want not only to get that stuff one way or the other, but there are some who get carried away with envy so strongly, what they'll do is try to become equal by taking it away and not taking it and give it to somebody, but just drive wealth down. For instance, I think an inheritance tax sort of does that. Just take it away from the family. Even if it's been in the family for 100 years and you had a business and a farm and a ranch and it was worth a fair amount of money and it was being passed down, some people... just recently, there was a major editorial on this from a well-known economist, and he says, no, you have to tax wealth, which is very uneconomic. It's just envy to get rid of the wealth, but it's uneconomic because it destroys capital. And that's where our problem is. That's why we have a weak economy, is we don't understand where capital comes from. It comes from hard work, efforts, and a savings over and above what we consume. Today, we're not producing very much. Our production goes down. We still have this desire, to promote it. But the economists who endorse these views easily adapt instead of accepting this idea that you have to work and have savings. What they say is, oh, we can create capital out of thin air. And that's how it invites and why I get so much involved in the monetary system. That if they just create monetary units, that represents wealth. And somebody will say, well, what does? I mean, if somebody wants to, if the Fed creates $1 billion and I hand it to you, I mean, in a way you have wealth, but there is a cost to it because there's wealth that comes out of this expansion by diluting real wealth, which is the problem of the distortions and the unemployment, the business cycle, inflation rates, and all the other problems getting governments to do the things that they shouldn't do. So envy is a powerful tool, but if it drives people to do things that just is to punish people, that is very bad. To look at people and say, you know, he has a lot of stuff, and I want some, I'm going to work harder, that's an incentive. So it's the envy that I think is different than just wanting, you know, something more. In this system today, the greed or the envy or whatever drives people, instead of the work harder, what does it do? It drives people not to invest in production and savings. It drives them to put more money into manipulating government. Build up the lobbyists, put money into the campaigns. The government is distributing the wealth, and it goes on and on. And that is what I think is a major contributing factor, along with a willing government that likes power. They're authoritarians. People go to Washington, mostly are authoritarians. They love the power that they have. And so this is built to subsidize those who are in power, and they use any tool whatsoever to create class warfare or hatred and envy and forget about accepting it. But these rules can be applied to social things as well. Sometimes people don't do things with their freedom that we resent, so therefore we have to control them. In economics, if people don't spend the money or they do things or they get richer than you do, then the natural reaction too often is to clamp down and we'll use government to do it. And, of course, from my viewpoint, we shouldn't participate in that, and we should overcome this temptation to ridicule or despise people who are wealthy.
Thank you. Our first question from the audience today. The Affordable Care Act has been repealed 50-odd times, or attempted repealed 50-odd times, with no success. Why keep repealing when it's working for 7-plus million Americans?
Well, I think it's way too early to decide whether it's working or not. I think most of those numbers, people went on Medicaid. And government management, I don't know, from my viewpoint, I don't have very many government programs. I say, you know, it really is working good, you know. Governments tend to mess it up. Because when you invite the government to do it, whether it's medicine or whatever system, what happens is that it becomes a political football. It encourages big business to get involved, and this medical care transition right now is, once again, it's a collusion between big business and big government. The Republicans and the Democrats have both done it. You know, whether it was Republicans, the health benefits, prescription drug programs, or what's going on now, the insurance company, what the heck? Everybody has to join them. A program that's no longer insurance is not, has in the vaguest recollection of being like insurance. So, but business people benefit, whether it's the medical industrial complex, whether it's the military industrial complex. Believe me, once government gets involved, you invite corruption. But even today, since Obamacare really hasn't operated yet, all we've heard about is the difficulty with getting signed up. But, you know, Medicare has been around for a long time. I had a personal philosophy about Medicare, and I never wanted anything to interfere with my relationship with my patient. So if they wanted to deal with Medicare, I allowed them, I took care of them, and that was it. But what did we find today? What is it, 10 or 15 doctors got millions and millions of dollars, and they were very much involved in partisan politics, and we're supposed to be surprised? No, once government gets involved, believe me, it becomes political instead of productive. You want the medical profession to be productive and competitive and produce good services, but you don't want to reward the doctors for cheating the system. And there's no way one doctor can do, what, $10, $11, $15 million worth of surgeries over the year. There has to be some fraud involved under those circumstances, and that's coming out. But we shouldn't be surprised about that. I think authoritarianism invites trouble. It invites political controls, and it invites too much spending and all the problems that we face today. So we should have a greater confidence and belief that markets work, whether it's in medicine or whatever industry that we're dealing with. I have a great deal of confidence that markets are working. If there's no aggression, no theft, no harm, no injury, and you obey and you follow your contract. Today we have a government that undermines property rights, undermines contract rights, or interfering with your contract with your medical benefits and your insurance company. So the government is supposed to prohibit counterfeiting. They're the biggest counterfeiters in the world. So we have a government that's supposed to protect us, protect our liberties, and yet we have a government doing the opposite. They're supposed to protect your Fourth Amendment privacy rights? Yeah, sure. Just send more money to NSA. They'll take care of us and keep it secret. Put it on the black budget, and they'll take care of us and protect us. And, of course, we're not supposed to have secrecy of government. So we have secrecy of government that we have to badger to get the information out, and we have our privacy undermined. It's supposed to be the other way around. We're supposed to know exactly what the government's doing, and they're not supposed to know anything we're doing if we're not doing any harm to anybody.
We have a couple of questions.
Thank you.
I don't want to step on the applause. We have a couple of questions from the audience regarding the current situation regarding Russia and the Ukraine. Not the Ukraine. Ukraine, excuse me. What specifically, one audience member asks, what do you make of John Kerry's comments about the current Ukrainian crisis, saying Russia is using 19th century tactics in a 21st century world?
Of ruthlessness, is he's implying. Well, I would say the most control that we have as individuals is over our own lives, and we're responsible for, and our family and friends and neighbors and something close. And when it comes to government, the most responsibility we have is for our own government. So it doesn't enhance our prestige nor the interrelationship with other nations if we're always accusing others and doing things and overthrowing their government, regulating elections and overthrowing the government of Ukraine and participating in that. And we've been doing that all the way back since 1953. And then somebody comes along who may be participating in a little bit of that, but maybe not exactly. And since, you know, Crimea happened to have been part of Russia for 200-300 years, so there's an argument that that is somewhat different. But the hypocrisy of this country, how we bully everybody and turn around and they do something and say, oh no, we don't ever violate the sovereignty of another nation. I mean, I don't know how anybody could buy into that. Do they remember, say, Vietnam and Korea and Iraq and Afghanistan and Syria and Turkey and Egypt? And it goes on. And we assume now that we have the authority to arrest anybody, any place, because it's the global war on terrorism, and we can take them, and we have a pretty good record that we torture people and probably still do, and all of a sudden that we assume the authority not only to go around the world arresting people and putting them in our prisons and having them involved in torture, we assume the right to go to any country and use drone missiles and bomb and kill people and target people, which is a lot worse than torture. You know, but we just assume, okay, it's okay to do this. And what has that done? It has undermined our respect for liberty, because we're supposed to be protecting our own people and our constitutional rights of our people here at home. But now the president has announced that it is perfectly all right to assassinate an American citizen with a drone. And, yeah, with due process, oh, yeah, we have a couple people sit down in my office and we decide whether he should be killed or not. And that's their due process. I tell you what, those circumstances, we as a nation, as a people, have to wake up and say, we cannot tolerate that, because if it more from, a condition where this was very, very infrequent and not policy. Today, it's been done for a long time. We have been around the world, assassinated people, and probably took out American citizens too. But when the policy is announced and they don't hide from it, it means that they are getting much bolder and it's much more dangerous. And the only thing that can stop it is the American people become alert, awake, and be determined to curtail that type of a policy.
Also, in recent headlines, the McCutcheon Supreme Court ruling on campaign finance, an audience member asks, what is the effect of unlimited money in political campaigns, and do you favor public financing of campaigns?
Well, the second half is real easy. I'm absolutely opposed to public financing, which means public. Who's public? Public means government. Government means they have to steal the money. They steal from one group and give it to another. Do you think the libertarians are going to get a fair shake on that? No, libertarians can't even get on ballots, because the others are in charge. You can't get your signatures and you don't get on the debates and all that. So public financing is that you're using stolen money to get involved in the process, and I'm positively opposed to it. But I'm also opposed to these strict rules and said that if you're a wealthy person and you have a lot of money and you want to help me in the campaign because you believe in liberty, it's your money. This is a free society. You ought to be able to. And you say, oh, no, this is terrible. I've already complained about big money in Washington, the big corporations, the military-industrial complex, the drug companies, insurance companies. That's an evil, and it's wrong, but that's the symptom. The symptom is there's so much to be auctioned off. And the government can auction off everything. They control all wealth, and they control the special interests, and there's an incentive. So first, government is too big, and as long as it's too big, there's going to be incentive to use money. But if the money isn't the problem, the government is too big. And you say, well, you can't get rid of that, so you have to do something about it. Even if we had more people in Congress that agreed with this, when's that going to be reversed? Not easily. So I have another suggestion. Until we change the government, of course, changing the government shouldn't be that difficult if we really wanted to as a people. Because what we could do, how to get started, is just have only people go there that actually read and understood the Constitution, and then all of a sudden the government would shrink, and then that would eliminate that. But the second option is send only people there that won't yield to the temptation of buying into these lobbyists. I have to tell you that the lobbyists never got in my door, and I never got in their money, and they never bothered me, not one bit, because they knew where I stood. And I think you need more people who will not yield and be tempted to do this. So it isn't the government, it isn't the people's money being spent. So the principle is that your money, spend it the way you want. And also the principle of petitioning your government is very crucial. So if you put too many rules and regulations on this, then that's going to be difficult. Actually, the minor change, it was really a minor change in that court case. There was more money being involved, and it's not going to solve the problem, because the problem is the big government and the role of government. If you want to solve the problem, you have to ask, as a people and as a country, what should the role of government be? Should the role of government be to be the central economic planner, regulate your personal habits, and police the world? No, you need all the rules in the world. You need the income tax. You need the Federal Reserve to deceive us and do all these shenanigans. You need to build all these political coalitions. But if you want a government to protect our liberties, no, there wouldn't. What would be the incentive? Maybe some of these big corporations would do it in research and development, R&D, and maybe they would give us better products and not have a need to go overseas to set up their companies or something. It'd be much, much better if we change the system than just adding on. Too often you have a regulation that's a problem, and then you say, well, we need a new regulation. Mises, the great Austrian economist, said for every economic regulation you put in will create two new problems. And then you have to have more regulations. But all of a sudden, guess how, look, go look at the Federal Register and see if you can read it. See if you can figure it out. This is one of the reasons. I talked to somebody once that was just setting a business up in China, you know, that terrible communist country. And I said, why are you going to China? He says, well, it took me 3 weeks to set up my business. He says, well, I live in California, but it would have taken me, I couldn't have done it in 3 years, you know, to get the permission to set up the company. So the regulations and all, so you just don't want another regulation on personal liberties. You have to understand what the real problem is.
Speaking of personal liberties, let's go back to the book for a second. From your section on discrimination, you wrote, in a free society, individuals are allowed to be creeps and pick and choose all their associations. That is, they can discriminate even when the majority disapproves of their choices. Outright foolish discrimination in business and elsewhere can quickly be punished by social and economic disapproval. The iron fist of government is not required to force integration and thereby undermine the principles of liberty. We had a case just within the last few weeks here in the Bay Area where Brendan Eich, the CEO of a company called Mozilla, had to resign from that job after only less than 2 weeks on the job because he was getting pressure from inside the company and outside for having donated $1,000 to Proposition 8 in 2008. That was the state constitutional amendment banning gay marriage. I, in the interest of full disclosure, Mr. Eich also was a contributor to Congressman Paul's campaigns twice in the late 90s. Are you okay with that? Is that a situation?
About him being booted out?
About him being pressured to resign for his political activity.
Well, you know, it's a mixed bag because it wasn't a law that did that. You know, most discrimination has been done by laws. Slavery was a law, the Jim Crow laws, the segregation, you know, in the military. So most of the discrimination has done by law. Now, this is done, I think today, people would punish a businessman or anybody else. In a way, they've done this, but I think it's way overkill. Mm-hmm. You know, I think this is political correctness orchestrated by both government officials and media figures painting people like that as bad people. Mm-hmm. And he, you know, might have had a very personal religious conviction of that did this, and I don't particularly think that makes him an evil person. But as a libertarian, I'm very open and very tolerant. I let people do what they want as long as they don't bother me, you know. And I want them to have their money as long as they, don't cheat people. So a truly tolerant libertarian, I don't believe would be demonstrating to make sure this guy lost his job. Mm-hmm. I really don't. Although it was a vehicle that there's no legislation that I could pass and say people weren't allowed to criticize him because he donated to Ron Paul, you know. So I think it's a cultural thing. But I think tolerance is the big issue, and this is why so many people give up libertarianism, because there are tolerance. And sometimes people say, oh, that's good. They'll tolerate our lifestyle and our smoking habits, our sexual habits, and tolerance. But then when it comes to an economic matter, they're totally intolerant. And I think it is the lack of tolerance. And one of the reasons why so many want to regulate personal habits are is because they're probably insecure, because if somebody does something they don't approve of, they think they've endorsed that activity. So if all our personal habits are legalized and you do something that is very offensive personally to me and against my teachings, I have to say, you know, I cannot discriminate against you and say you can't do this. And I believe that this understanding of tolerance is the way, and getting rid of all the laws that have been passed, which we have generally done a better job, except where's the greatest amount of intolerance and prejudice right now? It's in our court system. I mean, just look at the drug prosecutions. And this is why I'm so thankful that we're getting a handle on the drug war, and that has to do with states like California nullifying the federal oppression on these things. But if you look at a minority versus a white person being charged for the same crime, if you happen to be a poor minority, the odds of you going to prison not only for a year or two or even a life sentence with nonviolent activity, that is where, you know, the discrimination is still very, very bad. But when it comes to, you know, a case like running a guy out of a job, I think that's a little bit too much.
On a related question, in your chapter on demagogues, you wrote, the great heinous thought crime related to race relations is to argue that private property owners have a right to use that property as they please, as long as they do not commit violence against another person. Strict private property control is now seen as the most evil position anyone can take. The question is, if many or most private property owners or business owners start exercising a freedom of disassociation against a specific population, be it gay people or Muslims or Jews, isn't that a de facto tyranny of the majority that diminishes that population's liberty?
Well, I think it would be foolish and nobody would get very far and they would be punished. Property is key to the protection of all civil liberties. Property protects protects an environment like this because we have a building and we have a meeting, and it is this building that protects our right of freedom of speech. Our churches and our synagogues are pieces of property. It is the bedroom that protects sexual privacy. So private, you cannot have civil liberties protected without the understanding of property. And once again, just as somebody might offend us with their personal social activities, again, some might be stupid enough and foolish enough to do something that will offend you, but quite frankly, I think it'll do them a lot more harm than good. And when you think about it, the reversal of a lot of this occurred when Jackie Robinson became a baseball player. It had nothing to do with government actions. It had to do with talent and people becoming more progressive and understanding. So I think if you say that, okay, under these certain circumstances, because somebody might do something wrong, that if what you do is you undermine the whole principle of civil liberties and you undermine the principle of private property. So, yes, it's one of those things that people might say, oh, no, we have to regulate that, just like we have to regulate your money because you have too much of it. Even if you earned it, that's too much. So, Oprah Winfrey, we're going to crack on you. You've earned way too much money, so we have to back off on this. No, I don't like regulations, and I like to allow people to do what they want, even when they're dumb and stupid. As long as they do not exert aggression against another person. And guess who's exerting most of the aggression today? And that's government. Government's doing the problem, and that's what has to be reined in.
Perfect question from the audience to follow that up. Do you feel that government regulation can be done correctly? For example, hydraulic fracturing is clearly helpful to the average American, but it's crucial that we minimize chemical leakage and eventually reduce the amount of water used in excavation. How could the government help facilitate these healthy practices?
Well, in a way, it's government, but it's the government of protection of private property that takes care of these problems. In a libertarian free market, property-oriented society, I have already said no aggression and no use of force to make people do anything. But you have no right to pollute your neighbor's property. And you can't dump your garbage in your neighbor's yard. You can't put smoke in their air. You can't pollute their water. In Texas, some property rights have been worked out on oil pretty well, before fracking has come in. So a free market is very protective, but the government's responsibility is to protect the property and the right of the person that's getting injured. Mm-hmm. During the Industrial Revolution, the opposite occurred. Big governments and big business were like this. And I lived in Pittsburgh during the 30s and the 40s, and believe me, it was a filthy city. And the rivers were used as the sewers, and so it was big business and big government. They had no right to do that. But when it comes to fracking, I think it's a little more complicated, you know, because I don't think the question is sort of assume we have the final answer. I don't think we do. I've heard both sides of the argument. And if there can be harm done or is harm done, yes, I think there should be court curtailment of activity if somebody has suffered a consequence. But it is a little bit more complicated than dumping your garbage in your neighbor's yard because, you know, it's hard to decide what might happen. But there are some laws in Texas and other places on how they take an oil field. You know, your neighbor can't steal all your oil. You know, there are some precise rights on this, so your neighbor shouldn't be able to destroy your water under your property. The big thing is the science, and I think that government should do its best. But when it comes to regulation, I would advise, for many practical reasons, as well as the Constitution, that the government shouldn't come in and regulate everything San Francisco does. Mm-hmm. You know, you didn't want them to regulate smoking marijuana, so why should you have them regulate anything else? So I would think it would be best, but there would be some times, you know, if it becomes, you know, across national boundaries and it's an environmental issue or interstate. I mean, there would be times when, you know, a federal government should be involved, but it would be more to settle the alignment of who's responsible for the property rather than saying, well, we want to preempt everything and we're going to write a re-legging to make sure that you never hurt anybody. Well, this is like, you know, the greatest harm done in the history of the world has been some of the strange things that happen with fanatical religious beliefs and fanatical political beliefs. So, but how many people want to stand up and say, you know what we have to do is we have to have government because they're all wise, and we want them to regulate religious and also our intellectual pursuit. Don't ever be allowed to read a book on communism. It would be something. No, fortunately, not too many people are saying that. But when it comes to other things, more likely in economics, there's always prior restraint. But we would object. How many people would this? Would we be able to meet today if we had to have met prior restraints conditions? Oh, what's Ron Paul going to say today? You know, oh no, we can't. He can't come in because he might say the government's not our best friend. So you don't want to use prior restraint in social matters, and I don't believe you should do it in economic matters unless there's a clear and present danger, which is rather rare for those thousands and thousands of pages of the Federal Register that nobody can comprehend and nobody can follow it and just think April 15th is coming soon and no one person can understand that code anyway. And besides, even if they could, they're liable to use the code against political people they don't like. So that would be very bad too.
This is the Commonwealth Club of California program, and we are talking with former Congressman and presidential candidate Dr. Ron Paul. I'm Josh Richman, your moderator. You can hear Commonwealth Club programs on the radio, catch up with us on Facebook and Twitter, and see program videos on our YouTube channel. There was a recent, speaking of the tax code, another question from the audience. There was a recent IRS ruling on how to handle Bitcoin, the virtual valuation system, and they decided that it would be treated not quite as currency but as a sort of an asset. Can you discuss your thoughts on Bitcoin and government's role in regulation of it?
Well, the government should keep their nose out of it. They can. State officials can become involved if somebody commits fraud. So it shouldn't be regulated by the government, and it shouldn't be taxed. One of the reasons I've been associated with cryptocurrencies has been because I've had legislation introduced for many years for competing currencies, believing that the dollar is in big trouble. And even today, and what's going on in Russia, the dollar is under attack and it's going to get a lot worse, so people are looking for options. Hayek, the great Austrian economist, advised competing currencies using a basket of commodities, other things. And I want the market to make the determination. We should legalize competition, not only for us to have competition, but we need the right to compete with our own government. Governments, though, it's not the U.S. government, it's not new, it's the historic absolute of all governments having money as a total monopoly. They do not want to be challenged because if you can create the money, you are very, very powerful people. And that, of course, is why, since we've had a fiat currency since 1971, and it's a world currency, it's big time, big business, but it's also going to be a big time collapse when that happens. So the fact that the IRS comes along and said that we're going to tax Bitcoin, their declaration is, it's not a currency, and I'm not even convinced that it's a real currency, but it can be a substitute for transferring funds, and that should be legal. But the tax on here, of course, I don't like taxes. They don't need more taxes. I'm not for any new taxes. I certainly don't want to tax something that's trying to compete, with the government. So, but the taxes is to make the declaration our monopoly will stay in place. The strangest thing about our government not wanting any competition is if you take out an old silver dollar that might be worth $25, and you and I have a $25 transaction, and it's been on the books that gold and silver is legal tender, and it says $25, it says $1. Can't we do that? No, you go to prison for those kind of things because you have to use not silver and gold or a legal tender coin that the government makes. You have to use a paper currency which has nothing to do. It's a note. It's a debt instrument, and we are forced and compelled to use as money. So taxing Bitcoin is wrong. What's going to happen to Bitcoin? I don't know. I'm enthusiastic about the concept. I'm not enthusiastic about the coin itself. I don't know how it will work because quite frankly, maybe it's because I wasn't brought up with a lot of computers, but I've tried to study that and find out. I want to know what it is. I want to know what a Bitcoin is. I want to see one. And when somebody tells me that about a gold coin, all of a sudden I know what a gold coin is, and we have 6,000 years of history with a gold coin. And I kid those, even though I'm very sympathetic to Bitcoin, I kid those who are enthusiastic. I say, what happens? What happened after Vietnam fell? Some had to escape because the communists were coming in, and those who escaped usually had to get escaped with gold and silver. I said, what are you going to do? Take your computer and give them your wallet, give them your Bitcoin wallet, and they'll let you get out of the country. Don't think it's going to work that way. But that, but I see Bitcoin as facilitating exchange and transferring of funds. It should be legal.
In Congress, you had championed the cause of those who want to legalize the sale and distribution of raw milk. You called it the applicable food safety laws pasteurization without representation. yet the CDC has reported some outbreaks of disease associated with this. A member of the audience asks another food safety question. Should GMO foods be banned? Are they a health risk? Does government have a role to play in ensuring public health through things like food safety?
Yeah, they have an obligation for the government not to be involved in deciding good drugs versus bad drugs because they've done so much more harm by putting bad drugs on the market, and they had the FDA seal of approval. Thank goodness I was reluctant to use new drugs, and it did me well in my medical practice. But how many times, every night you hear an ad on TV, well, if you've ever used this drug, call me. I'm going to sue somebody. I'm going to make you a billionaire. And guess what? It was an FDA-approved drug. So, and they keep good drugs off the market. There's good evidence for that. So yes, there is a problem when people make up their own minds. But if I make up my mind and say, you know, I think I'll drink raw milk, and I'm not careful and don't realize you need refrigeration and a few other things, and I get sick, you know, I took a risk and I suffer the consequence. But when government does it, they make all of us sick. They come and tell us that you will take these immunizations and you will do this and take it. Today there's an article out that said, you know, the flu pill probably isn't worth much, you know, after all this activity and the flu shots and all. But it's better to make up your own mind. You don't want a law to get rid of the GMOs. But, you know, the market was so far ahead of the government because, you know, my wife and I look at the labels and all. In the last year or two, it's miraculous on what has happened. You know, Whole Foods come out and they provide food and knowledge, and you can read labels, gluten-free. The market is telling these producers what to do. That is a healthy way of doing it. The best thing to do when we're concerned is don't accept the good housekeeping stamp of approval when it comes from the U.S. government, because they're a bunch of bureaucrats and they usually work for drug companies and they promote things that, you know, some of this mental health testing. I used to fight that all the time. Be the only one to vote against this mental health testing of every kid in grade school, so that they can put them on drugs, and a lot of them are on drugs. And then when you hear about the shootings, or even our veterans when they come home, they're on drugs. They're on these psychotropic drugs, and they make billions of dollars off this. So I would say that they don't have a very good record, and private choices will not be perfect. Let me just tell a very brief story. I was raised in a dairy, and at that time, the farmers would, you know, send the milk into us. We would pasteurize and thought it probably would have my dad turn over his grave if he thought that I was championing raw milk. But to me, and I don't drink raw milk, but I champion the cause of freedom of choice. That's right. I mean, I've never even seen anybody smoke a marijuana cigarette. And I was the, you know, along with Barney Frank, I was the one that was leading the charge on freedom of choice, true freedom of choice. You make up your own mind about doing risky behavior. So it is freedom that we want. We don't want dictates. We don't want authoritarians who are the do-gooders who think they know what's best. Yes, you know what's best for your personal life. You know what's best how to spend your money. And you may mess up. Just don't try to blame somebody else for it if you mess up, because there'll be others that your family and others might help you if it's an accident. But if you turn it all over to the government, you end up where we are today, a totally bankrupt government undermining our liberties at perpetual war, and a pretense that, well, when things get messed up, we can always go to the government. The government will take care of us. Doesn't work, and that's the most enlightening thing that I know about today, is more and more people are now saying, you know what, we have to question what the government is doing. And I think that is very, very good. And most people now do not endorse the two major priorities. You know, they're drifting away and not accepting the conventional wisdom of what we've been listening to for so long.
Let's go to a purely political question from the audience. There is a civil war in the GOP between the establishment and the Tea Party. I would actually submit that it's more than just a two-sided war, perhaps, that's going on there. But putting these labels aside, what is the one most important idea the 2016 GOP presidential nominee should embrace, and can the GOP win in 2016?
Well, first thing off, you know, I don't work day to day, even when I was in Washington and a Republican congressman, worrying about the GOP. Because the GOP is just an instrument, it's a vehicle. And I tell all my crowds that if you're going to depend on, if you think that you can get into the GOP and change things, it might help. And obviously I was there and hopefully made a little bit of difference. But if you want to change things, you have to change the non-Republican, the non-Democrats, the grassroots people, and get people to have an understanding. Richard Nixon said in 1971, when he closed the gold window and put on tariffs and did all these horrible things that ushered in this age of fiat currency, he said, "We're all Keynesians now." Which means that Republicans and Democrats will no longer, will be very bipartisan. And he was right. It had been that way and still is, that the leadership of both parties endorse economic interventionism, paper money, and all the bad policies that we have. So if you want to change things and you want the Republicans to have that one policy, it won't do anything. In a way, you might see a little bit of that when you see the Republicans in the House voting over and over something, and it never goes anyway. You have to change people's attitudes. An example of that is when there was a consensus with the American people, when Obama was forced to have second thoughts about getting into another war. I'll tell you what, you and others evidently notified your congressman we don't need a new war, because many who had supported all the other wars decided, no, we don't want to bomb Syria, and we ought to at least talk to Iran. So this was the change, but it was bipartisan. But the question was, is there one thing the Republicans could do and maybe help win the election? Well, yeah. Preach civil liberties in a pure sense of the word, preach non-intervention overseas, and get rid of Keynesian economics, believe in sound money, and get rid of the Fed, and then maybe they'll make some headway.
Term limits. Are you familiar with the movement limiting legislators to 12 years? How would this impact our current situation?
Limiting terms to 12 years? Mm-hmm. It might help, but probably not. Once again, I go back to the ideas. We had some people who self-limited themselves and would leave after 6 or 8 years because they promised to do that. And they were the more honorable people, and they were good people when they were there, but their replacements were always worse. So if you limit terms, but you haven't changed people's attitudes, if they still want government to take care of them from cradle to grave and want to fight these wars, and they don't question the Federal Reserve and they don't question the military-industrial complex, term limits won't do any good. Now, in the 1970s, I was the first one to introduce term limit legislation, and I voted for all the term limit legislation in the 1990s. But I'm very unenthusiastic about it. I don't think that is the issue. The issue is what the people want and what they think. And then you say, oh, no, that's impossible, because half the people don't even care and they don't pay attention. The congressmen don't write our letters. But it's the prevailing attitude. It's what's in the leadership positions of people, whether they're in the newspaper business, the TV people, or the teachers, or whatever, who does and helps orchestrate and move people in a certain way. Now, I could not get the members of Congress to, because I had no legislative clout, to endorse the principle of auditing the Fed. But because we had outreach programs to millions of people outside, they called their congressmen, and we got Democrats and Republicans, and we passed it twice in the House. So that's where the action is. It's with you. But the temptation to be frustrated is understandable, because usually the majority goes along, but you have to have, a minority that's, irate. As Samuel Adams said, irate, tireless minority, willing to start these brush fires of liberties in the minds of men. And then you will have changes. But I would say that we're making more progress there than a lot of people realize, and that's why basically I've been pretty much of an optimist that things are changing. But then again, I go to those college campuses, talk to those young people, and they seem to have a greater open mind than the older codgers that I ran into in Washington, D.C.
We've had a couple of additional questions dealing with health care. Let me try to condense these down. One person is asking, to what extent do market solutions rely on equal access to information and the ability to walk away from a bad deal, and aren't health care decisions fundamentally incompatible with both? Another person asks that during one of the Republican presidential debates, You were interrupted before you could answer the question of whether an uninsured patient should be allowed to die if he can't afford treatment. What would you have answered?
Well, you know, it's sort of one of those questions that when did you quit beating your wife or something like that. it doesn't even make any sense. You don't let anybody die. More people die when you live under a communist system for health reasons. You know, we know that in even our system today, I complain enough already about government involvement and misdirecting use of drugs and people dying. And we have how many people committing suicide, you know, coming out of the military. So what are, you could throw the question back to them. Are you just going to let them die when we send them over and ignore the whole problem of being over there and fighting these senseless wars? Are we going to ignore that and just simply, well, you know, when the killing just occurred at Fort Worth, we have to study this and find out what the motivation was. Yeah, he was distraught, as they are, so many when they come back from these wars, and they don't know why they're there, and the American people seem to be oblivious to what's going on. They become depressed. They go to the government doctor, and the government doctor drugs them up. So the question is, are you just going to sit back and let them die? And I say, no, I'm not going to let anybody die if I can do anything about it. I'm going to try and change the basic flaws. And if it has to do with the delivery of the health care, I just happen to believe the delivery of anything is better done by private sources. I mean, compare FedEx and UPS, compare that to the post office, you know, and people usually know the difference. So you just have to have a better system, but to pretend that if you don't have government medicine, all doctors are going to sit back and let people die. I practiced medicine before Medicaid and Medicare. I came out of medical school, worked in a hospital with a church-run charity hospital, and nobody was turned away. Everybody was treated. And this whole idea that before the government started taking care of us, there were no problems, just wasn't true. The government has messed that up so long, you know, with the interference on who gets health care. The tax code has messed that up. So if you really care about people having trouble, then you have to care about the cause. And the cause so often has been the meddling in the delivery of health care by our government, because people thought, you know, people are easily motivated to say, well, you know, medicine is different, Ron. You have to have free medical care. You know, whatever free medical care means, you know, and then you end up with the mess that we have. And so those who see this problem say, well, what we need is much more authoritarian rule. We need one system, and then you'll get rid of another 50% of the doctors and wonder why the quality of health care goes down.
Thank you. Given the situations in Colorado and Washington and the debate that is almost constant here in California, are you for or against the mass commercialization or recreational use of drugs such as marijuana or crack or heroin?
I legalize everything. And people should make their own choices. The only thing that's illegal is using aggression against somebody else. And if that is the case, all substances should be legal. You know, the same question in a very liberal South Carolina audience. They asked me, "What do you mean you'd legalize heroin?" And it wasn't a flat out yes or no, but no denial. Yeah. And then I asked the crowd. I said, "All right, if I legalize heroin tomorrow, how many of you are going to use heroin?" Didn't see many hands go up. So it's the whole idea of who's responsible and what would people do. So what happens is once the do-gooders get in there and say, well, we're going to regulate alcohol, and that didn't work out so well, now we're going to regulate marijuana. But if we regulate marijuana, you know, hemp looks a little bit like marijuana, so we have to regulate hemp too. So hemp has nothing to do with psychotropic drugs or anything. So what do? We destroy an industry. It just out of this fantasy of government protection against ourselves. When we assume the role of government can protect us against ourselves, whether it's fanatical thoughts, political or religious, or against what we eat or put in our mouths and our body, I tell you what, it won't work, except for one thing, it will destroy your liberty. Freedom of choice is a great idea, and just so you understand that it's not perfection, but like I said before, if you believe that government has to do that because you might do something wrong, why is it that you want to take a few people and put them in Washington and make the decisions for us? What if they do something wrong? And that's constantly what's happening, whether it's the economic policy, and look at all the decisions they make for us sending our kids off to fight these stupid wars, undeclared, unwinnable wars that have been a great burden to us, and they're endless. It's going to be decades. Even if we quit the wars right now, it's decades to take care of the problems that we have created for this generation. And that to me is so avoidable. It can be avoided. There are some things in life you can't avoid. You know, if the lightning strikes and a tree comes down on you, I don't know how to prevent that. But I tell you what, much of what we have, economic and as far as the slaughter and the killing of a generation of young people, that's avoidable just with some common sense. And the common sense also would lead us to some guidance with our Constitution, which if we had followed the Constitution, we would be fighting a lot less wars.
And speaking of foreign affairs, an audience member asks, how should we address the Palestinian-Israeli peace process, and what do you think of John Kerry's efforts?
Well, I think John Kerry's efforts are about status quo. They're par for the course. We go over and pretend that we're the arbiter and we can take care of it. Sometimes we bring them to the United States and we make these settlements and we give people money. And it might work for a while, but never settles the problem. I think that John Kerry should have probably just stayed home. Because sometimes when we go and get involved, we make things worse. If we endorse this idea that we get involved, whether it's the Israeli-Palestinian affair or whether we're allowed to use our NGOs to overthrow, the government of Ukraine, which we did and spent many billions of dollars doing, it doesn't help us at all. So you say, well, you mean you just leave them alone? Yeah, I would from our perspective. I don't. I think it makes things worse. We don't have any money to give away. I mean, look how many billions of dollars we gave to Egypt. We gave all that money, and that had to do with, Israel-Palestinian-Arab conflict. And we've been pumping money into there since, I guess it was 1979, a lot of money. So finally, people, and we get tired. You know, Mubarak's a bad guy. We're tired of you, or you're tired of us, so we're going to get rid of you. We're going to have a great election. You know, we promote democracy. We're good Democrats in this country. So we get our election, and we get Morsi in. And turns out, not such a nice guy. And so we get rid of him. And now we have another military dictator that's worse than all of them. And I think it's just worthless to do it. That doesn't mean that we shouldn't have a moral position. I think people, should be able to participate by going there or sending money or whatever they want. But the one thing the United States government to do is really work hard at international relations of trade and friendship, so that if people weren't given so much money, maybe they would be forced to do more free markets. And free markets is what, I mean, why couldn't we advise both Arab and Israel to have, why don't you try to develop Hong Kong, and try to make some money on this deal and let us trade with you, let people go back and forth. That's what solves the problem. Even with the problem with Russia right now and the problems building in China, and some people are determined that we have to have a war with them, we're really in a lot better shape than we were when I was in high school and college because of the Cold War. Of course, I got drafted in the 60s. The fact that we trade and they're dependent and they have a little bit of clout, China's our banker and they can crash our dollar anytime they want. We're less, there's big talk to appease, you know, the militants. But overall, we're better off trading and talking with people and being friends. And that's what we should emphasize, not that we can give somebody money or give both sides money and say, don't do this or do this. I've argued the case that we have only two options in foreign policy. We go to a country and we say, okay, we need an election, and if we have a friendly dictator, we're going to give you a lot of money. But if we have an unfriendly dictator, we're going to bomb you or we'll overthrow you. And there should be a third option. Why don't we neither bomb them or subsidize them and give them money? Why don't we just treat them like Canada, you know? Why don't we just go back and forth?
An audience member asks, President Eisenhower warned us about the potential danger of the military-industrial complex, yet it seems to be stronger than ever. How do we contain this beast?
You can't get rid of the beast unless you get rid of the policy. And there's a motivation. You know, the big arms manufacturers, I mean, they're behind a lot of these resolutions in Congress, to stir up trouble and send weapons. One senator now is saying, he wants to escalate in Ukraine. And he said, we have to send them, at least send them weapons. And but the whole thing is two things there. One, it would subsidize the military-industrial complex. But the other thing is, if we decide to send $10, $20 billion worth of weapons to Ukraine because the Russians are coming, guess who's going to pay for it? You're going to pay for it. But there's going to be somebody make a lot of profit. So the motivation is that you have to change the policy. We don't need to be so well-armed. We spend more money than the other countries of the world. You know, and if you add up all of China and all of Russia on their military, and they're the ones who are about to attack us now, it's one-third of what we spend. But a lot of ours is just for the military-industrial complex, because they are behind all this. There was one time we had a big debate over Colombia, and we were going down there and, root out all the drugs and invade their country that nobody ever realized. And the big argument was which helicopters we were going to buy. You know, and I don't remember the names of the helicopter. Are we going to buy these kind or these kind? And back and forth, depending on what state they were being built in. Mm-hmm. And so they split the difference and sent both kind of helicopters. But if you,
a bipartisan solution.
Yeah, bipartisan. That's the bipartisanship I don't like. And then what's the new fighter? Is it the F-35 that it's being built? It is a culture because we don't need a fighter jet. I mean, we're not going to have dog fights anymore. We need to defend our country, but we don't need this jet. It doesn't even work well. And guess what, though? It's built in 48 different states. And now, and I'm sure, I don't know where the major parts are. Guess why? Because, boy, when it's in your state, you better not vote against jobs for your state. So the conservatives are Keynesian. The military Keynesianism is a very real thing. Conservatives always complain about Keynesians are always wanting to create jobs, doing, silly work. But the Republican conservatives are exactly the same. They love these jobs. But I think both Democrats and Republicans, go both ways, whatever enhances their reelection campaign.
Very briefly, in terms of enhancing their reelection campaigns, we have a great distaste for Congress, our polls tell us. People are not happy with Congress. And yet, why do we keep electing these same members of Congress? Why is there such a high retention rate?
Well, we're always hoping for a change.
With the same people?
Yeah. No, I mean, they'll start kicking some out. Occasionally they are, more so now than they were 20 years ago, but you're right. Probably, I don't know, it might have been 90% were reelected last go around. It's still, but I think it's because the individual congressmen, are closer to the district, and even though it's theoretical that we want a clean house, well, I know my congressman in case I ever need him. And it's almost like either way, if I need to get something is one thing, but what if you need the government to help you get the government off your back? See, that's almost legitimate. How can you calm this agency down? So, no, I think it's the personal attachment. The congressmen know it, so it just keeps going.
All right. We've reached the point in our program when there's really time for just one last question. I'll try to compile a few questions into one. People want to know what your future plans might be. You keep up a busy speaking schedule, obviously. One audience member wanted to know if there's going to be a Ron Paul University someday. As somebody else wanted to know if you might consider running for governor of Texas at some point.
No to the last. No university unless it's internet. But I am very much involved in educational activity with the Free Foundation as well as the Mises Institute. But I've also started a Ron Paul curriculum. So I'm interested in a generational change, and the public school system is not being well received these days. Almost every day you hear something, and parents today think, what do I have to expose my kids to? The economy prevents a lot of homeschooling because, you know, people need two people working. But it's a curriculum mainly addressed, it's not a evangelical Christian curriculum, and I'm not opposed to that, but if I the more the merrier homeschooling program. But this one is designed for the freedom philosophy, essentially the philosophy that I'm talking about, because it is tolerant and open to all forms of beliefs, religious beliefs, and freedom of choice, which are considered both liberal and conservative. So I will do those things. I will continue to going to the campuses. I was there at Cal State last night and had a nice reception, and I feel good about that, and that's where I get encouragement. And I have the Ron Paul Channel, which is an effort to produce some programs and get out information. And it really is designed to try to get truth to the American people, because I think the American people will do the right thing. And I really preach the gospel of questioning the propaganda. And I don't think I have time, but Hermann Göring has this unbelievable quote about propaganda, how every government can use it, because just say, if you don't go with us, we will declare you're unpatriotic and you don't care. So getting the truth out, as far as I'm concerned, to my best ability, is a job that I'll keep at.
All right. Our thanks to Dr. Ron Paul, former U.S. Congressman and Republican presidential candidate and author of the book Liberty Defined, in addition to 9 others. We also want to thank our audiences here and on radio, television, and the Internet. We want to remind everyone here that copies of Dr. Paul's books are on sale in the lobby, and he will be pleased to sign them outside this room immediately following the program. We do need to also let you know that because of a tight time schedule, Dr. Paul will not have time for any posed pictures or to personalize his signature. We also appreciate your allowing him to make his way to the signing table as quickly as possible. I'm Josh Richman, and now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, the place where you're in the know, is adjourned.